Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 133, where Fritjof, Sarah, and Tom are discussing a series of works from Henry Mintzberg, whose career as a consultant and management researcher spans decades and has resulted in many articles and books that provide critical perspectives on dominant schools of thought in organizational design strategies and planning. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
So I think maybe it's now a good time to look at another article on patterns in strategy formation, because I think it speaks to the discussion of Tom and Sarah. So in this article, Mintzberg argues that, so to say, by definition, strategy scholars have excluded a lot of what strategy actually is, because his PhD thesis looked, so to say, at the work of managers, what do they actually do, and highlighting that by taking a broader definition of strategy as a pattern in a stream of decisions, we get a better understanding of how strategy actually is done in organizations. And out of this work, he compares the strategies of Volkswagen from 1934 to 1974, and the United States government in Vietnam from 1950 to 1973. And he highlights in his theorizing this dynamic interplay between the dynamic environment and something he calls bureaucratic momentum, and how the two are mediated by leadership. And I think this idea of the bureaucratic momentum is really interesting, because what it basically highlights is that there are moments where it's actually problematic to have a strategy that is too specific, because the organization starts to run with it. Not questioning anymore the appropriateness of the strategy, but simply demanding, so to say, obedience and using control to so to say, enforce the strategy that has been defined at some time. And he also, I think, nicely kind of highlights how there are different kinds of leadership needed for different times in, so to say, your strategy. He talks about the meta strategy, so the strategy of strategies. And that if you look, so to say, in a lot of detail, you see, of course, a lot of decisions. But if you take a bit of more of a broader lens, you see bigger shifts or lack of shifts in the meta strategy. And I thought that was really interesting, this bureaucratic momentum. And I think, Sarah, maybe that is something that relates to what you just said, that funders and universities would not allow you to basically entail in your planning that there is something like uncertainty, and not just risk, but uncertainty. So basically, fundamentally, I don't know, I can't say 10% all over. I'm saying I need another item and I do not know what that item will be, but I know there will be something like this, and therefore I have to do proper planning, maybe in a way, by adding these 10%.
Yeah, I'll also say that one of the things about how it gets into the decision-making calculus of an organization, if you do have a 10% that is not specifically engineered and accounted for in a rigorous, or a, I shouldn't say rigorous fashion in that way, it becomes something that can be reprogrammed, can be taken away. And so when I think about strategic programming, part of it is a recognition that the organization as a whole has far more demand than it has supply of resources. So then, in addition to the risk and the uncertainty, is to what extent are all of the different missions actually sufficiently resourced to begin with? And how do organizations start to look at under-programmed activities in one place and reprogramming from those who have stuff that looks like it doesn't have a purpose? And anything that is a 10% miscellaneous category would be the first thing that a programmer might look for, you know, depending on what kind of programmer we're talking about, and say, okay, sorry, I've got a firm demand over here. You know, I'm just going to harvest and reprogram that. And so sorry, next time, tell us exactly what you're going to do with that money. And I guess we can start talking about how those sorts of bureaucratic patterns kind of interfere or influence the what we're really trying to get at with strategy and planning.
Yeah, absolutely. Because we have to do risk planning, and then we have to do a risk mitigation table. And then as part of corporate governance, you have a schedule, a review schedule, and a committee that will plan all of those things. That's all there for risk, but not for uncertainty, right? Because to each risk, you have to assign a probability, you have to assign a threat level, you have to assign a priority order, which order you're going to address, but not for uncertainty. I'll give you another example. So I have a funding bid that's under evaluation that's about AI and the creative industries. And the point of the example is that we went through some internal peer review while we were drafting, and someone asked us, how are we going to respond or incorporate the changes in AI in our proposal here? Because we're proposing in 2025 for a project to run 2026 to 2030. How can we talk about the future instances and applications of an constantly evolving technology? And it was a good point for them to push us to think about how would we change our design, or what are the potential implications to our planned project if it's built on a certain technology now that doesn't exist 2 years later or gets reissued again 2 years later. And that was a new level of as you say, meta planning for me that I don't have a lot of experience with. But it was a good exercise. And now this reflective discussion is about why was that so hard for me? And I think it comes back to just my need for closure. Like I said, how many different headed hydra do you have to work out before you can say, I've handled them all, or let's move on with the actual doing of the thing?
So maybe let's move over to the article of Strategies Deliberate and Emergent by Mintzberg from Strategic Management Journal in 1985. I just want to highlight kind of like the core idea here, where he highlights that even though, of course, there are intended strategies, so to say, so someone has an intention somewhere and this is the strategy, that he highlights that there are, of course, also unrealized strategies. So just because someone says this is the way to do it doesn't mean that actually necessarily happens. Then there is something called deliberate strategy, kind of like where it works out. But I think what's really important is he highlights that there's also something called an emergent strategy. So basically, by opening up the lens on strategy as this pattern of decisions over time, there's also patterns that can emerge out of decisions that are being taken without someone necessarily beforehand having intentionally defined the strategy as such. So he highlights this emergent strategy and how emergent strategy and deliberate strategy together become a realized strategy. And that basically, yeah, it's a lot of strategies are, of course, somewhat both. There is deliberation, there is emergence. But he highlights that we should also study this emergent nature of strategies, which I think also resonates with our discussion. And just to finish out the five articles, let's talk quickly about the design school, reconsidering the basic premises of strategic management, again in SMJ, but from 1990. Where Mintzberg develops a critique of the design school as a kind of like this more traditional perspective on strategy making, and instead proposes to engage more with this more emergent way of engaging with strategy. So that brings together all five articles and the book that we discussed.
Yeah, and the deliberate and emergent strategy I just opened up in his book, Rise and Fall of Strategic Planning, is he, I don't know if he had a similar chart. And of course, the listeners aren't going to be able to see the chart as I am raising it up to the screen here. But it's basically how he synthesized the ideas of the roles of deliberate and emergent strategies together as what he says should be an effective strategic planning process in which you have a bit of both. So you've got to have some aspect of it, which is pre-programmed intended set the lighthouse on the hill, but while a different part of the organization or a different facet of the organization exercises the need for outreach, the need for learning in order for these emergent strategies to go. So I take this as kind of like a little bit more formalization following what you were discussing there.
I'm still on this thing about meta research and applying these lessons to ourselves. I think that's the theme of my current research program, and it's the theme of my role here between the two of you. So one of the pieces from the article I prepared, Emerging Strategy of Direct Research, is trade-offs. Trade-offs, and you know, you raised this, Tom, that you find yourself in zero sum, whether you thought that's where you were when you started or not. And that one of the points in the middle that says, our choice is not between true and false theories so much as between more and less useful theories. And usefulness, to repeat, stems from detective work well done, followed by creative leaps in relevant directions. So how do you feel about that in the other direction? How about if we take that point that he raises about research, which seems the least controversial of all of the points raised in the article, what if we said how that applies to plans? Our choice then is not between true and false plans so much as between more and less useful plans. And usefulness stems from detective work well done. So in the planning example, homework well done, preparation and understanding, listening, meetings, pre-assessments well done, followed by creative leaps in relevant directions. So tolerance for uncertainty as in part one, or willingness to think out of the box. So if we adjust that for planning, how does that fit with the scholarly bits on planning that you two have read?
I'd like to play with the levels of analysis on here because, you know, now you're taking the position of the individual researcher. And so you're developing a research agenda which purports to achieve a particular theoretical outcome or a practical outcome. And now I'll put myself in the position of being on the administration side where there is a need for programming, strategic programming and planning at the university level or the larger organization level, in which we have revenues and we also have desires for a strategic outcome that promotes the university. And we have to develop a research strategy that is supposed to help with encouraging the influx of those resources, whether it comes from individual faculty or some other endowment. And since I don't work in a traditional university, y'all can correct me on, you know, how I'm characterizing this. But I think that Mintzberg, he's actually trying to address both issues or both perspectives on it. Everything that we're talking about in terms of planning, the role of a plan, the role of a strategy, whatever, applies both to your perspective as an individual researcher and the broader organizational perspective. There's a lot of commonality, just difference in scale. But then at my level, now you have somewhat more of a separation, say, between the administrator and a planning function. It is no longer all in a single individual who is planning and implementing all at once. At an administrative level, and this is where I think he really, in the book that I read, he's really going after the role of planners as a discrete, separate entity from, say, the primary decision maker, who's the administrator. And there, the planning function takes on a different level of complexity because of that detachment from the line administrator's decision-making calculus. You know, I might, whereas you have total vision of what it is that your outcome and the path of that outcome looks like, I'm at my level, have this group over here that is trying to figure out how to manage 9 digits worth of resources, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to ensure its distribution across capital investments, faculty research, and all that sort of thing. And having a detached process that helps with shaping what that looks like. There, the question becomes, all right, to what extent now is that separate planning process creating burdens for you to justify what is your required slice of the pie, or potentially introducing uncertainties towards you because we might make reprogramming decisions without your input. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I think your observation is spot on, which is that we haven't stopped doing this. We've just stopped making it a single person's job description to do this, or a single person's responsibility to do this. Each of us has to generate these kinds of plans, student recruitment plans, research group growth plans, knowledge exchange plans, non-tuition revenue generating plans. You know, we all have to generate these things. Back to my example, or my parallel to actuaries, I don't think anyone has a problem with a lot of planning. And I don't think anybody would mind if we did go back to making planning a named role. I think where most people's frustration from planning comes is that we're all being asked to do it with very little training, very few models, and then they seem to go into the void. They go into the void until someone comes and says, okay, we have a review cycle and it's 3 years since we reviewed the plan for, you know, internationalization. But everyone's unhappy even with reviewing. Do we review them too frequently? Do we review them too little? Do we review them just for funsies? Do we read them just for fun and nostalgia? Or do we actually take a critical eye at them? And does that matter from where in the organization they originated? So in the spirit of two things can be true, right? I think your observation that we no longer employ chief planning officers is fair. Some might say that's folded into the operations suite, right? It ultimately ends with the, or maybe you could debate whether it's a strategy versus an operations portfolio if you have two different officers with that in your C-suite. Universities for sure rely on distributed expertise, and therefore, as we've discussed in this series about experts before, the experts make the plan. I think you're right that if somebody made decisions without proper consultation, the concerned stakeholders would be frustrated. But nobody was trained for this. Nobody stands up and says an expert planning. I think actually, you know, if I may step slightly even farther outside my discipline, strategy is only 1 foot outside my discipline. But if I could go 2 steps outside my discipline and talk about what my expert colleagues here at my institution focus on, and that's project management. And I would say what I see them doing and delivering and trying to make an impact in the world of major project management, major restructuring, IT change delivery, I think that's where all the professional planners have gone.
Yeah, that's a fair point, because he doesn't get into project management, which is indeed its own it's kind of an extension of this, I suppose. Because it is it's about a particular implementation of some strategic outcome. I guess I know you're into signaling, you know, and part of Mintzberg's point about raising the idea of strategy as vision is that in some cases it's just important to have a strategy, even if it's something that isn't even used or doesn't actually drive very much, because it signals to others that you're looking at the future. But then we run into the issue of, well, okay, what decisions actually get made? What decisions are actually driven by something like this versus, say, what is a bureaucratic process that has become so thoroughly institutionalized that even those who question it can't seem to change it? Because the machine, and Mintzberg gets into the machine metaphor in his book too, the machine just keeps turning the crank despite efforts to try to invoke a little bit of strategic thinking into this. How do you recognize that you're in that sort of a rut? Just because you do strategic thinking doesn't necessarily mean you have the ability to influence the systems around you. And just complaining about the system, the complaining about the bureaucracy certainly doesn't mean anything, because the bureaucracy serves a purpose. So it's all circular. It's a bit of a mess. And unfortunately, I think sometimes the discourse about, you know, when we start complaining about plans and strategies and all that sort of thing, it gets a bit emotional. because we feel like we don't have control over which way the strategy or plan is going to go or how it impacts us. We just know that it's in our way. It's preventing us from doing what we think we should be doing, which is why I think some people are just altogether in favor of get rid of planning in its entirety. Just ditch the bureaucracy.
But why do you think strategy doesn't have that emotional reaction the way planning does? Nobody says get rid of strategy. Nobody says, I don't want a vision frozen in time and plastered on the entrance lobby of my building. You know, I mean, people might disagree over some elements of it, but I don't think many people disagree about the item in instantia. Yes.
So I think the strategy, the thing is just that people just ignore it. I've had that in numerous organizations, both ones that I've worked in, but also those that I've studied, where they basically are like, yeah, strategy is there, but like, what does it have to do with me? And I think with a plan, it's more difficult to ignore it because their work has been, so to say, defined. But strangely, the way that a lot of organizations are doing it, it's not too difficult to ignore it in a way in your day-to-day operations.
But that's also assuming my question was only about negative emotions. I said, why doesn't anybody have the same kind of emotional reaction to a strategy as to a plan? And both of us were in the discussion went to friction, resistance, ignorance. These are all negative emotions. I don't think anybody has the kind of positive emotions about a plan the way they do about a vision and a mission. Again, I'm thinking about Drew's article about the mission to the moon and the different ways that the mission resonated and gave purpose to the individuals working at the organization. Even with a very good plan that's time-bound, that assigns owners to tasks, that includes measures of success, that includes review periods, that includes all the elements you need, you never hear anybody talk about it in the language of relief. Oh, good, we have a plan now. We know where we're going. Or, okay, great, we have people who are assigned to specific responsibilities who have to report on specific outputs, and they will take care of those, so now I don't have to. You don't have that sort of positive discourse around it the way you do for the big corporate strategy launch events and things that you have. And I don't, you know, I find that really interesting because planning engenders positive emotions in me. I like planning, right? And tourism likes planning. There's a lot of tourism research that says that 80% of the trip's enjoyment is in planning and living in that future and in having something to look forward to. So it's not that no plan ever engenders positivity. It's just we don't have the discourse at our fingertips here of positivity.
Yeah, I think depending on the type of organization or the setting, but I suspect that strategy and plan, I don't know that a lot of people really do couple those. They divorce the two, I think. I think Fritjof's point is absolutely valid that the strategy, like, for example, when a bureaucracy, a bureaucratic organization generates a strategy, it is almost expected that this is a document whose purpose is really not to drive very much. It's more of a public relations move that the document is there on a coffee table. It impresses visitors, but it is somewhat divorced from the reality of the day-to-day of the organization. Managing the day-to-day reality becomes more of a plan. And the ones who write the strategy document are different from those who write the plan. I can say that about those bureaucratic organizations I've been in. The public relations group, or a group of folks who are very, very close to the leader of the organization, are the ones who generate a strategy document, and it's printed on glossy paper, and it is usually, you know, it's very heavily branded. Whereas the plan, any planning document, is generally just like a regular Word document that is intended to be shared and is intended to be adhered to. The plan may reference the strategy, but maybe it doesn't. I have seen plenty of them in which it really is divorced. Or just, you know, acknowledges that the strategy exists or that it is supposed to help implement the strategy. So I guess in those types of organizations, when they're divorced, you end up with a real disconnect. And I think it's also kind of reflective of how, say, in large bureaucratic organizations, the leadership, their A number one focus is up and out. And then you have the line managers whose focus is down and in. And so strategies serve one purpose and plans serve the other, if that makes sense.
Yes. I would have said that as an introduction, as we said, to our business school students, to our even undergrads these days are talking about that because we're doing, that's why we call it a business plan, not a business strategy, right? When you're getting a startup, creating a startup and looking for funding, you say, what's your business plan, not what's your business strategy? I'm not sure that answers my point about emotion entirely, but I understand it. I understand it. If we think from an org theory perspective and we look at artifacts, you're right. The artifacts we have are strategies, or, drumroll, a strategic plan. We have that as an artifact as well. We do a lot in this series about looking at materials in their historical context. And Tom, you're always excellent at helping us to understand what was the organizational pressure at the time, what was the zeitgeist, what was the macro pressures, and even sometimes up to the level of diplomacy. So the sources we've chosen today go from the 70s into the early 90s. So maybe if you can give us a few of your thoughts there about how what we are reviewing and analyzing here we've done with the whole benefit of hindsight, but what perhaps might have been the more bounded reception in the time periods that we are reviewing here.
I don't think much has changed in 30 years. I think that from a practical lens, of course, I'm sure theoretically there's been a lot of advancement, but from a practical perspective, I don't think very much has changed. I think that the approaches to the purposes behind strategic planning, what planners do, what plans are, has not changed. The complaints have not changed. The fear, you know, the simultaneous fear of bureaucracy has continued along with the embracement of it because of how bureaucracy can help protect us from ourselves. So the tension is still there. And the complaints that we have about the quality of strategies and plans, I don't think has changed much. So it sort of gets into a deeper philosophical question, I suppose, if we are talking about organizations, are we condemned as an innate part of organizing to be dealing with this difficulty of being able to come up with ways and means of moving and progressing organizations forward without creating a bureaucratic nightmare in its wake?
So I think on this, the article Patterns and Strategy Formation is giving a nice example of, so to say, the role of bureaucracy here. He writes, any large automobile company, talking about Volkswagen, is mightily constrained by its technical system. Retooling is enormously expensive. And this is what having a background in the design also.
We've covered quite a bit of ground. It's very clear that he has had this longstanding theme that has run, in which he is critical, consistently critical of the traditional design school approach that has come up. And unfortunately, I think we can probably agree that the work that he's done to try to get us to rethink the roles of plans, the roles of planning, et cetera, still hasn't quite taken on. A lot of the complaints that he rose back in 1994 and earlier, still kind of pervade. And there we see the contemporary raising of the same questions. You know, what is the purpose for planning? Is planning actually causing us to not be in a position, or is our bureaucracy, is our processes, whatever you want to call it, is it preventing us from leveraging this incredibly rapid changing technologies and all of these things that are happening in the environment and trying to bring them into the organization? Is the present way in which we do planning getting in our way? is, does it need to be chunked and start over? And of course, I think Mintzberg, especially in this book, kind of says, no, we don't want to say, we don't want to chunk it, but boy, does it need to be transformed. There's a lot of work to be done. So I think that's a good message. And I think that his prescription that he has in this particular book of rethinking the roles of the people, the process, and the products is worth another look. I think it would certainly help us contextualize the sorts of questions that are being raised about planning and strategies nowadays.
So then if you were advising doctoral students looking for a topic, hello, doctoral students in the audience listening to us as an addition to your basic courses. If we, again, then have a think about, I like the looking at his distinction between strategy and org theory, right? Because we've talked about before in this series that some of us were trained org theorists, some of them were self-taught org theorists, some of us were accidental org theorists, depending on what department you studied in and then found yourself in for your subsequent positions. There was more of an overlap that macro OB was strategy and org theory when the papers or the materials we've discussed today were produced. I no longer think that applies. You've heard us, certainly Pedro and me, discuss in other episodes meso level theorizing and how we are trying to push for meso OB or meso level theorizing and pull org theory back towards meso so everyone can find a level of analysis that suits them. And this is the first time, it's certainly in the piece that I prepared for today or prepared primarily, that you're talking about strategy as the phenomenon of interest. Strategy is the object of study designed not to produce a strategy itself as an output, which is something that I certainly struggle with in reviewing and then attempting to even use in my own research more heavily macro papers. And I think this is the first time, I don't know, maybe you'd say we're looking under the hood, that I feel that I can understand the mechanism as much as the shiny output.
Well, what I wonder is, do we need to broaden the scope a little bit when it comes to strategy formulation or plan formulation for that matter? Because in other episodes, recent episodes where we touched on economic sociology, where we touched on some of these other fields, we do abide by this idea that strategy serves a purpose that is drastically different and somewhat decoupled from planning. Then perhaps we need some better theorizing about strategy informed by economics, informed by politics, informed by things that are a bit outside of the traditional mainstream of org theory, which might help us come up with, say, a more practical approach to strategy that really serves the kinds of interests that perhaps org-focused theorizing strategy development has overlooked or disregarded. And I can understand why org theorists have probably not wanted to tread in those waters, because it's a whole different language. It's a whole, you know, as we covered in those previous episodes, it's a whole different language, a whole different thought process. But I think that level of synthesis is needed. Otherwise, we're going to continue to follow down the same path, I think.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.